Now, the Archive Hour. Jerry Northam charts the rise and fall of the British Union of Fascists and the career of its leader, Oswald Mosley, in Pottery's Fascists.
According to a recent poll among historians, Oswald Mosley was the greatest villain to emerge in 20th century Britain. As an MP, he had the distinction of resigning from both the Conservative and Labour parties. He saw himself as a leader of the left over unemployment in the Great Depression. But what ensured his notoriety is that he then went on to form the British Union of Fascists, modelling himself on Mussolini. When he secretly married a second time, Hitler was a guest at his wedding. But to large numbers of people here in Stoke-on-Trent, for most of the 1930s, Mosley was a local hero, the most celebrated Staffordshire man since Josiah Wedgwood the Potter. 75 years ago, Mosley stood for Parliament in Stoke in the 1931 election. Later, his black shirts paraded from their headquarters here in Glebe Street, just round the corner from the railway station. And there was another active branch to the south of the city in Longton. They were hundreds of apparently ordinary people attracted to fascism from both sides of the political spectrum. Using recordings made over the past 30 years with many who have since died, we can explore what drew them towards their heroic or villainous leader, and why a movement which promised a renaissance of national pride ended in derision and disgrace.
Well, the wife and I, we put this black shirt on, we looked at one another, and, oh, come on, you better show yourself. I just gave her a kiss and I went on my way, and she wished me all the best.
There's nothing really sinister about it. If I liked to put a black shirt on and walk round Stoke-on-Trent, I was merely saying, I am a fascist, and people would say, oh yes, he's one of Mosley's men.
And this nation again and again in the great hours of its fate has swept aside convention, has swept aside the little men of talking of delay, and has decided to follow men and women whose day we go forward to action.
I've always thought there's nothing nicer than a good military brass band and the accompanying soldiers marching through a town. And as far as that went, had I been in Hitler Germany, for instance, if there was plenty of that about, I'd have just loved it.
And I claim that in the ranks of our black shirt legions march the mighty ghosts of England's past.
Mosley told the people, you can't band people together by love, because love isn't half as strong as hate. You've got to have a common cause to hate, and Jews were the ones to hate.
I never had any sense at all that anything could go wrong with what I was advocating. I felt entirely in the service of the good.
Uncovering the story of the Pottery's black shirts began for me in 1975, when, as a reporter at BBC Radio Stoke, I was sent to meet and interview Oswald Mosley, who was the guest speaker at a local public school. His subject was Britain in the 1930s. Our recording turned into an hour-long encounter which has never before been heard on national radio. Mosley was almost 80 and behaved as if he were a great man, upright and striking in appearance, gently charming and utterly self-confident. I was more than usually nervous, and as he turned the notoriously penetrating eyes on me, I tried my introductory question. It was straightforward enough. What was it like coming back to his Staffordshire birthplace after all these years? Without a moment's hesitation, he turned it to his advantage, sketching out an international political creed.
I feel, have always felt, intensely Staffordshire, very proud of my origin. It's one fact of my first patriotism. I have a patriotism for Staffordshire that was extended to all England and extended to Great Britain. And now, ever since the last war, has been extended to Europe. Really four patriotisms: Staffordshire, England, Great Britain and Europe, which are not conflicting but complementary to each other. In fact, we cannot preserve our British patriotism, our British character today, unless we have the strength and the protection of the whole European community of which we're a member. Just as we could not have an isolated land and patriotism in Staffordshire without the protection of Great Britain. This is a steady process of the extension of patriotism, but I'm very thankful and always happy to feel that my roots are in Staffordshire. That is where I began life, and that is my first initial patriotism.
And that was just the warm-up. He went on, as you'll hear, to expound his approach to the economic crash of the 1930s, why he thought fascism could take root in Britain, how he organised his supporters for systematic violence, and why his attempted revolution failed so spectacularly. There was also the biggest question of all, how he could defend the virulent anti-Semitism of his movement. Even in old age, there was no doubting his charisma. But to understand the attraction of Mosley's message, I had to find supporters and opponents who'd been active in the 1930s. It soon became clear that an essential source of support for the Black Shirts was the Depression and the terrible hardships it had brought to local families. One of those Mosley would have recognised as an enemy was Alderman Horace Barks, who lived in Smallthorne, a district near the Potteries town of Hanley.
Oh, things were terrible in Smallthorne. I was the secretary of the local branch of the Labour Party, and people used to come to... People were members of the Labour Party, I think, to get the help that they thought we could give them. But the outstanding thing I remember in that time was a big chap who was an unemployed steel worker, and his father was an overman at Sneed, because his father had a tidy income. Earn was cut off after the period of covenanted benefit, I think it was called. And Earn came to me to see what I could do. Well, I tried, but his father was getting so much money that Earn was hopelessly away from ever receiving any benefit. And he said, well, if I cannot contribute anything to the family table, I'll not gain it. And he didn't. His father and mother tried to persuade him, particularly his mother, but he would not eat until he was ill, and she called in the doctor, and the doctor put him on the club. He drew club money and he started to eat until he got so well that the doctor cut him off the club, and he again starved. And this was like the fat and the lean pig, you know. He wouldn't eat when he wasn't able to contribute to the family table. He said, now on again, live on thou, mum.
For Mosley's supporters, the local Blackshirts, memories of poverty in the Depression were still vivid. One, with an air somewhat like Captain Mannering, was Norman Swan, who had grown up without even a potential breadwinner.
I was in what is now known as a one-parent family. I lived with my mother and my grandmother, and she had the job of looking after me and getting what bit of money she could by letting rooms. Not in a large sense of it, but just one lodger. I've seen the time when, well, generally, we just had to live, so to speak, on what we could get out of the money paid by one lodger. I've seen the time when I've sat down for a meal and we had one egg between us. Someone had the egg in the egg cup, and then some of it was spooned out onto the bread and butter of the second party, and then the third party got another helping. You see, that's how it was done.
Norman Swan lived in Chesterton, on the outskirts of the Potteries, and was himself unemployed for much of the 30s, despite having done well at school. He was a natural Tory of the far-right wing before becoming a fascist. Being out of work had clearly proved a scarring experience for him.
We had to sign on three times a week, about 9:30 in the morning. And you know, I was so ashamed of being unemployed that I used to walk from Newcastle, where there was a labour exchange, of course. I used to walk all the way to Hanley to sign on at the Hanley Labour Exchange. And I remember once one of the clerks looking at my dossier, he said, you live in Newcastle, don't you? Well, what did you come up here for? Well, I couldn't say because I'm a snob, could I? And I just kind of looked blank. I couldn't explain why I did, but it was because I was ashamed of meeting people in the Labour queue in Newcastle whom I might know.
Politically, it was unemployment which brought Oswald Mosley to the centre of the national stage. In the 1929 Labour government, he was Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, with special responsibility for dealing with the biggest problem facing the country, the worst effects of the slump. His proposals were radical, involving a huge programme of public spending to create jobs.
We then had an acute deflation, exactly the opposite to what you've got now, and it was necessary to reflate the economy in the right way, provide where it was most needed. And it has since been agreed and admitted, I think, that in the circumstances of that time, the policies I then devised were right. And, of course, I was supported at the time, openly supported by Keynes, who I knew very well. I was to the, certainly to the left of the Labour government in that I stood for action, government intervention, an active interventionist policy, and long-term reorganisation, turning our back on what I call the export fetish and adopting the remarkable proposition that the British people should be allowed to consume what they produced at full production, and it is only necessary to sell abroad enough to buy foodstuffs and raw materials which we couldn't produce at home. And most of that would have been obtained from the empire in those days. So it was a very drastic restructure, not only of the machinery of government, but of the whole of the economic thinking of that time. But again, my misfortune, or fortune, has always been to be too far ahead of my time.
This policy brought Mosley friends and admirers on the left of the Labour Party, particularly in the ginger group, the Independent Labour Party, ILP. Prominent socialists like Fenner Brockway, who disliked Mosley personally, agreed with his own high assessment of his talents.
Oh, tremendous ability. He was on our finance committee and was really formidable in his arguments, which led to the ILP adopting a very large part of his attitude towards finance. He used to have conflict because he used to combine his opposition to monopoly of finance with the Jewish race, even then. Oh, but about his ability, there was no doubt whatsoever. And personality, platform, able to influence masses of people. And it really was his speech on unemployment at the Llandudno Conference of the Labour Party, when at the end of his speech the whole conference rose to him and applauded, as I very rarely heard anyone applauded, which shows his ability not only to put a case, but dynamic leadership, no doubt about that.
When the cabinet rejected Mosley's remedies for the slump, he made a fateful decision, breaking with Labour and forming his own political vehicle, the New Party, precursor of the fascist movement. He had been assured by Labour friends that if he held on, his policies would eventually win the day. But patience and humility were for lesser men. Mosley stood for action.
I wanted to organise a party, a grassroots party in the country, having been in the Labour Party, and worked for 13 years within the system and failed to get anything done for our people, finding every pledge was broken. I then moved on to try and create a new movement from the mass of the people to do these things which had been so long neglected. The housing of the people, the land fit for heroes to live in and all the rest of it, as we were promised after the First World War, with complete betrayal of all my comrades and friends, complete betrayal by the politicians of every pledge ever given to them. And when I'd failed in the old parties, either Conservative or Labour, to get justice done to our people, then and not before, I started another party.
Left-wing support for Mosley fell away with his new party. One radical MP who followed him out of Labour was his wife, Lady Cynthia, the member for Stoke. Among their left-wing colleagues in the Independent Labour Party, she had been much better liked and more widely trusted than her husband. Fenner Brockway recalled the clear difference in their personalities.
Oh, they were very, very different. Oswald Mosley was in the Independent Labour Party at that time, came to our summer schools. Cynthia came. But Oswald Mosley was always isolated from most of us. He was, even then, authoritarian, distant, above us, dogmatic, in a sense dictatorial. Cynthia, on the other hand, was one of us. Perhaps the distinctive thing about the ILP at that time was its sense of fellowship and of comradeship. And Cynthia was one of us. She used to sing beautifully Negro spirituals, and the contrast between Oswald Mosley and Cynthia Mosley was that of someone who was so confident of his own beliefs that he was determined to impose them on others, while Cynthia was more modest, of us, willing to learn from others.
Largely because of Lady Cynthia Moseley, the new party formed a strong appeal in Stoke. Many long-standing Labour supporters and activists left to join its ranks, and for some this was to prove a first step on the road to full-blooded fascism. One of the most enthusiastic recruits was a bus driver called Sam Dunn, whom I met shortly before his death 30 years ago. He signed up for the new party because he believed in its programme of national reconstruction. But principally, he believed in Lady Cynthia Moseley.
She was the one, I mean, not always the background from a working man's point of view, but when you saw and heard this Lady Cynthia, she was one in a million. It brought a new light on people's lives, I thought. There seemed to be an inspiration coming from her, which you couldn't find it in other people at all, at least in the people that I was concerned in politics.
When Lady Cynthia Moseley resigned from Labour, she caused a local political sensation. More than 3,500 people packed the King's Hall in Stoke to hear her explain her reasons. Most were spellbound. In the election of 1931, she at first stood for the new party in Stoke and looked as if she could win. But ill health forced her to withdraw, and Oswald Moseley himself stepped in as candidate. Preparing to vote, Norman Swan liked what he saw.
He had everything, as far as I was concerned. First of all, he was an aristocrat. There's no doubt about that. And as an aristocrat, he mixed with all the right people, the ruling class. Secondly, he was, of course, well-educated naturally. He was clever. There's no one can deny that he was a clever man. Thirdly, he was a fine physique and an athlete. He had, I think, practically every attribute that you could think of which would have led him to eventually the leadership of the nation.
But the new party was a disaster. None of its 24 candidates won a seat. Oswald Moseley came third in Stoke with 10,500 votes, one of only two who managed even to save their deposits. When I asked Moseley how he explained this rout, he blamed the electorate.
Great people seek the easy way out as long as they can, and who can blame them? Well-known figures come forward saying, well, we'll all get together and we'll settle this for you. And if it's not very bad and distrust hasn't gone too far, they inevitably vote for the established system. They don't want great changes until they're certain great changes are necessary. And if unemployment, instead of being 2.5 million, had been 5 or 6.5, as it was in Germany, then new parties would have been desired. As it was, of course, new parties were simply disturbing the old concern.
The electoral catastrophe of 1931 proved decisive in Oswald Moseley's shift to outright fascism. Speaking recently at his Westminster office, Moseley's biographer, Robert, now Lord Skidelsky, traced his steps from defeat at the polls to the pursuit of victory by revolution.
Moseley's own views were in a state of transition, and it was, I think, just after the election of 1931 that he went to Rome and to study the modern movement. I mean, there was this idea of the modern movement, which went beyond parliamentary politics and was a sort of already being seen as a modern movement for a new age, which was an extra-parliamentary movement. It was more a movement than a party. I think he was already thinking in those terms. I think he was young, he was impatient, he was arrogant, he believed he had the answers. He was fed up with the old gangs. He was already calling them the old gangs who had betrayed the hopes of the war generation and so on. All that rhetoric was already there in the new party. But at the same time, there was a quite solid economic program, which was just as important to him. He was this curious mixture of an economic technician and a romantic at the same time. His model was very much the wartime British government of Lloyd George. And so he was thinking the situation was like that of a war. and there was a survival problem for Britain, only it wasn't the enemy, a foreign power, but it was the enemy of the collapse of the economic system, and that a government to fight it had to have the same kind of power to act as a wartime government had, which meant the suppression of peacetime liberties and the elimination of obstruction. But the new feature was the break with parliamentary politics. This movement would be, it would fight elections, but once it won, it would abolish the old parliamentary system. It would change the constitution. Other parties wouldn't be allowed.
Less than a year after his trouncing at the polls, Mosley launched the British Union of Fascists, the Black Shirts. The uniform, he said, was a response to heckling and disruption at some of his new party meetings by organised groups in the audience. Mosley blamed the Communist Party and determined that his new movement would not tolerate such opposition.
The label fascist arose in this way. First of all, let us understand that in every country, the fascist movement, being ultra-national in character, had entirely different policy, attitude and performance, a different attitude altogether. The reason, of course, of saying at a rowdy meetings, the answer is fascism, was that it meant standing up to organized, violent, communist opposition. I had a perfectly clear choice when my meetings were broken up, either closing down, saying, all right, I'll retire and have a very happy life, which being quite well off, I could have simply retired and enjoyed life, or defending my meetings. But there was no other choice whatever. I could not have spoken any word in this country at that time unless I had young men with me who, after three warnings and every appeal for order, would put out the people determined to prevent free speech. That was the origin of fascism, and the link with the foreign movements was simply this, that they'd had the same experience, and they'd had to fight to defend their meetings. Now, as everybody in my old profession, the irregular army, knows, you wear uniform, and people have all through history worn uniform, in order to recognize each other in battle and in fight, not to hit your own people when there's a general melee going on. And therefore, we all wore various colored shirts in order to recognize our own people. And that was linked us in the popular mind to some extent with foreign movements, but that was the origin of it. When you fight, you've got to recognize each other, as every soldier knows.
In the Potteries, fascists soon began sporting the new black shirts. The first to wear one in Stoke was the bus driver Sam Dunn, when he went out selling the paper called Black Shirt.
Well, the wife and I, we put this black shirt on, we looked at one another, and we looked at the papers, and, oh, come on, you'd better show yourself. And I just gave her a kiss, and I went on my way, and she wished me all the best. And I went on down London Road, down through Anford, Trentham. I sold quite a few papers in Trentham, around Ash Green Quarter there, and up into Longton, and then from Longton down to Fenton, then through Victoria Road, up to Arnley Market Square. We held a meeting there, sold out the rest of my black shirts, and we walked down to Stoke. I had no insulting remarks. I never heard one. I mean to say, they were young in the ways of our movement then, and they only knew the movement from what policy had been expanded, so that they couldn't have any animosity against that. But I'd got what you might call butterflies in the stomach, Clark.
Other members soon followed suit.
Well, it was just an ordinary black shirt, and it was buttoned down the neck, came right down by the left-hand side, right the way down, just above your trousers, and then you used to wear a cummerbund round it. The uniform was supplied by the club, somewhere in the region of about 9 shillings, which I think we paid off for so much a week, something like that.
I don't know if you remember, but at the time, the great writer of beautiful music was Ivan Novello. Well, he dealt all with Ruritania, in which all sorts of handsome young men went about, put their feet on tables, drank out of Stein mugs and toasted beautiful ladies, and of course wore lovely uniforms. And I think that that kind of thing is really quite divorced from war, you know. I think that people do like uniforms. It's a kind of fascism, if you like. And I've always thought there's nothing nicer than a good military brass band and the accompanying soldiers marching through a town. And as far as that went, had I been in Hitler Germany, for instance, if there was plenty of that about, I'd have just loved it. Not loving war and all the horrors of war, but loving military parades. And, of course, you've got the same thing in Italy. Sorcerer Moseley himself has said that the black shirts were worn purely in order that he could identify his own men in the scuffles that broke out outside the meetings. You can talk yourself into any belief, and he may have done that. Well, I think the reason was entirely different. Two reasons, I believe. One, you must remember that it was mostly the unemployed who joined the fascist clubs, and they were very, very down and out. And they didn't look very smart. Now, if those men all wore a black shirt, by the way, they were modelled on the fencing shirts that Oswald Mosley wore as a fencer, they did look quite respectable with a black shirt on, quite smart. Now, that's one reason. The next thing was that every man who walked about with a black shirt one was just like a sandwich board man, wasn't he? He was advertising fascism. There's nothing really sinister about it. If I liked to put a black shirt on and walk round Stoke-on-Trent, I was merely saying, I am a fascist, and people would say, oh, yes, he's one of Mosley's men, and the idea would get about that there were a lot more of them than there really were, and people would always jump on a bandwagon, so it could do nothing but good for Oswald Mosley.
We should be smart in appearance, what they told us, that we must be smart in appearance because people were watching us, and, for instance, if we were smart and kept in step, then they would say, there's a disciplined lot of fellows. Those are the people we want to be with. If we walk about slovenly, well, they wouldn't want to know us.
As with all fascist movements, the key to recruitment and motivation was the leader, Der Führer, Il Duce. Mosley commanded by the power of oratory, and even his most bitter opponents accepted that he was a master of the art, able to sway whole crowds by the passion with which he spoke.
This great audience is gathered tonight, filling the largest hall in Great Britain, to hear the creed of the post-war world and the polity which Great Britain has sought ever since the war. It is a policy in accord with the new economic facts of the modern age, and a policy more than that, in accord with the spiritual urge of the post-war period, the urge to build a Britain worthy of the sacrifice our generation made.
I thought, well, I'm going to go to listen to him. He's coming to Stoke. I don't know if many people who are living today have heard him speak, but I'll say this, that when I listened to him, I was completely enthralled by him because he really held me and his speech made sense to me. My intention was, as soon as possible, to join.
The wife and I went across from Fletcher Road there, number 60, and he got on this box there and he took his jacket off, rolled his sleeves up, and he verified what we already formed an opinion of him. He was there. He was the goods. A man like that, he just couldn't be a failure. He couldn't let you down.
When I met the great orator in the quiet surroundings of a sunlit Staffordshire drawing room, I was keen to learn how he had approached a major political speech.
Well, it's a tremendous effort. The worst part of it is before you go on, particularly as in my case, while I'm not a teetotaler or a Puritan in private life, though I'm very moderate in the way I live, as a rule, but I'd never touched anything except a cup of coffee before a speech. And starting stone cold sober, great many politicians in those days, anyhow, had a good deal to drink before they started. I would start absolutely cold and the audience be cold, and by the end of the speech they would be greatly excited and so would I be. Doctors would call it the thyroid gland in operation, the adrenaline and all the rest of it, and the problem then was going to sleep. My problem after meeting, I usually sleep very well, after addressing an enormous meeting and the tremendous excitement and emotion and that oneness with the crowd, it was very difficult to sleep. But it is a tremendous exertion, in a way almost comparable to athletics. Above all, you would want to convince them that what you were saying was reasonable, analysing it simply in terms which everybody could understand and most would agree with. Then import the emotion. Well, what are we here for? To save this country. What is this country? And in its glorious history, its great possibilities, the feeling of community. Here we are in Stoke-on-Trent, all English people together, determined to save this land, this county we love, and this land we love. They talk about hypnotism and the rest of it. There's nothing of that sort. What it was giving people a passionate feeling they'd got to dedicate themselves to that cause. That is the point of oratory,
to be able to convey the man's own conviction, his own deep faith in the truth of what he is saying to a mass of people, so that he, one helpless individual, is multiplied 100 or 1,000-fold by people passionately devoted to that cause, who couldn't explain it as he explains it, but who feel it when he has explained it to them. That is the object of oratory.
Sooner or later, in the lives of great nations, comes the moment of decision, comes the moment of destiny. And this nation, again and again in the great hours of its fate, has swept aside convention, has swept aside the little men of talk and of delay, and has decided to follow men and movements. What day we go forward to action, let who dare follow us in this hour. That is the permanent, the mighty mood of Britain. And I claim that in the ranks of our black shirt legions march the mighty ghosts of England's past, and their strong arms are round us, and their voices echo down the ages, saying onward.
Did it ever frighten you, the power you had over an audience?
Well, I was so absolutely convinced that it was being used for good ends that I never had any doubt or qualm of that sort. I was perfectly certain that if they did what I asked them to do, it would be good for the country and good for themselves. And therefore, I never had any sense at all that anything could go wrong with what I was advocating. I felt entirely in the service of the good, and I had absolutely no doubt that what I was doing was for the best, as I conceived it.
Among the fascist faithful I met, there was no doubt about the greatest thrill the movement could bring. It was going to one of the huge rallies which Mosley staged in a clear echo of the techniques of Hitler and Mussolini. They were attended by thousands of blackshirts. Norman Swan, the propaganda officer of the Longton branch in the Potteries, remembered joining forces with the comrades in Stoke to hire a fleet of buses to go to a regional Mosley rally in Manchester.
Well, on the way going, they were singing the songs of the day, you know, that In the Valley of the Moon and things like that, you know. And in a lull in the singing, one of the two or three women members struck up with the black shirt anthem, actually taken from the marching song of the Rome branch of the Italian Fascisti. And it was a very, very nice tune. Well, you can't imagine anything in the way of tunes coming from Italy that wouldn't be good. They love music. The words were as follows. Up ye fascists, form your legions. Hold your flag forever high. For the weal and might of Britain, stand ye fast to fight and die. And then there was a kind of chorus which went, see the Mosley men are marching, marching for a greater Britain. I thought the words were very, very nice, and the tune was really lovely. It's a real marching tune. La 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 la. Well, we arrived at the hall, and again, we didn't excite any comment from the crowds. There was a crowd lining the roof, but it was raining. I think that kept the numbers down. And we went into the hall, and we met a lot of fascists from other places. I don't know where from, but some would be from London, obviously, and from various places. And they all gathered together in the hall. It was a kind of an anteroom to the real hall where Mosley was to speak. And that was the only occasion on which I ever saw Mosley close to and in an informal way. And it's always remained in my memory for various reasons. I'll tell you all about that. We were packed in this room pretty much like sardines, waiting to go in when we were placed by the ends of the aisles. And Mosley came in accompanied by a couple of henchmen, obviously men from headquarters. They wore the full black shirt uniform, black trousers, very, very smart, black shirt, leather belt, the rest. Now, Mosley wanted to go right through the room, and I don't know whether he was going to some other, perhaps changing room or something like that, the other side. But the only way, of course, was to elbow his way through the crowd, but that was not the way Mosley did it. It wasn't Mosley, just wasn't him, to elbow his way through a crowd. He wouldn't do it. I've said that there were trestle tables all down one side of the room, and these trestle tables were perhaps about 18 inches apart with a form between, you know, so that people could sit on them. He leapt onto the first trestle table at one end of the room and bounded the whole length of those trestle tables, one table per stride, right from one end of the room right to the other. From an athletic point of view, it was a pretty remarkable feat, and if it was meant to impress, it certainly impressed me. When the audience was all in the hall, it was rather done on the Hitlerian style, I think. Those who would stride in and stroll right down the entire length of the hall to where the rostrum was, and mount the rostrum, and we'd be accompanied by two or more of his henchmen. I'll call them henchmen. It's a very good way of describing them. And he would go down, and of course he would start off with the fascist salute, which of course we all gave, and then he replied to it. And then Mosley would start. He spoke for a pretty good while, and of course I don't think anyone else ever spoke when he did. When he spoke, that was a lot, that was a ration. And of course, like all speakers, of course, the waving of arms, the clenching of fists, and all the tub-thumping, as they call it, he may have been influenced by Hitler. I should say that he possibly was, but if it comes to that, Mussolini and Hitler both adopted very much the same style. There's nothing really wrong about that, but I think he was rather theatrical himself, you know. And he was a born leader, and I think that that kind of thing would come as naturally to him as it did to them.
It was the behaviour of Mosley's supporters at some of these rallies which did much to bring the fascists into early disrepute. Hostile members of the audience would start heckling as Mosley began his speech, and blackshirts would swarm in on them, sometimes guided by searchlights which swung round to pick out the hecklers, who were then bundled out roughly and given a sound beating in the corridors outside. There was nothing accidental about this. Mosley had carefully organised his muscular young men into what the press called Biff Boys. They were trained in innocent-sounding youth clubs, the first of which Mosley opened in London, and the second in Stoke.
The primary idea was a sense of national renaissance. I, at that time, was representing Great Britain in international athletics. I went all over Europe and the world in our Olympic fencing team at that time. And I deliberately encouraged the idea of national revival through sport. I've always been involved in all my life long in sport. I couldn't fence for Great Britain any longer. My legs don't work as well, but I hope and think my head works better than them. But it was a sense of national revival which was the origin. But then naturally, having these clubs, where there were a great many people doing boxing, judo and that sort of thing, we naturally used those men when they volunteered for it in order to defend our meetings. We said, we've got a youth club we're going to open, and young so-and-so, a well-known local athlete, is in charge of the club. And you'd find those clubs filling up in no time. They were a tremendous success.
Mosley consistently claimed that his Biff Boys were a legitimate reaction to violence used against him by communists. We shall rely, he once said, on the good old English fist. And there's no doubt that the blackshirts did. Their provocative marches, particularly through areas of East London, led to open fighting in the streets as communists and others attempted to stop them, and on occasion succeeded. Many observers believed that Mosley used these confrontations as a deliberate way of projecting fascist power, the message being, stand against us at your peril. So how far does Mosley's biographer, Robert Skidelsky, accept the leader's claim that the use of violence was just defensive?
I think he's half right, but only half right. His meetings were attacked, and they would have been closed down. But then they were also attacked because they knew... I mean, they were attacked largely at first, certainly by communists, and they were looking for a fight, and the fact that they would get a fight was something that they wanted. But it cast them into the role of the most vigorous opponents of this of fascism. So there was something tactical about their attacks on the Mosley meetings. But that equally, he saw these clashes as a prelude, in a way, to the final battle, when, as he said at some point, we would fight over the stricken corpse of parliamentary for power. He saw it in that way, and then he needed to establish that he could win. And so there was quite a strong motive of intimidation in the way he dealt with hecklers. He could have got a lot of sympathy, obviously, had he been cast in the role of someone whose meetings were being closed down, who was a fighter for free speech, and they would have got a lot of sympathy, but not the support he was looking for. And the support he was looking for was, here was someone who can smash the communists if he needed to. So there was that element. It wasn't just defensive.
In his later years, Moseley made an attempt to rewrite a central piece of fascist history in Britain, his policy towards Jews. For decades, the reputation of the Blackshirts was marred by accusations of blatant anti-Semitism. But when Moseley later published his autobiography, he denied that this had ever been his policy. He had never, he insisted, attacked anyone on account of race or religion. In 1975, addressing a historical meeting at Abbott's Home School in Staffordshire, Moseley made the same bold assertion when asked about his movement's connections with Hitler.
There's no doubt whatever a vile crime was committed in the war of murdering, at any rate, a very great many Jews in cold blood. And any decent man, and certainly any professional soldier, does not believe that prisoners should be ill-treated and killed in cold blood, whether they're Jews or whether they're anything else. That was a vile crime. It is, of course, perfectly true that the Germans were an anti-Semitic movement. That is, they attacked Jews on grounds of race and religion because they were born Jews and were and continued to be Jews. Now, when I began our movement in 1932, I never mentioned that subject for several years. I was absolutely unaware of it. I even ran Jewish candidates, and I had absolutely no anti-Semitic feeling. Now, what happened was two things. First of all, the Jews saw their people being ill-treated in Germany, which, of course, they were being ill-treated, not murdered at that time, but badly treated. And secondly, they thought we were going in the same direction as the Nazis, and therefore they attacked us. And 50% of the convictions of violent crimes against our people in the streets happened to be Jews. Now, for that reason, and that reason alone, I opened out and attacked them. You may say that I attacked them too much, but that was the origin of the whole quarrel. Another thing I did not like about them was that some of their great finance houses were financing our competitors. It's the subject of much criticism today, not only about Jews, but about other people. All over the world were creating industries in direct competition, sweated industries of cheap labor, in direct competition with British industries. And that was an economic reason, added to the two reasons I've just described. But none of that meant attacking Jews on grounds of race or religion. That was not anti-Semitism. That was a quarrel with certain Jews, not with all Jews, on very clear grounds, a thing which is now entirely past because it's a quarrel which belongs to that period.
When this defence appeared in Moseley's memoirs in 1968, it was instantly challenged. A moderately sympathetic review in The Times prompted an exchange of some of the most bitter and longest letters that paper has ever published. The correspondence began sarcastically with a letter saying that Moseley no doubt believed what he'd written. It went on, "The capacity for self-delusion possessed by a man whose political life has for well over 30 years been one of unrelieved failure must be almost infinite." Somebody, it said, had to set the record straight. The author was the columnist Bernard Levin. And after my interview with Oswald Moseley, I went to see him.
There's no doubt at all, there's ample documentation, that Moseley expressed in his speeches, in his party papers, and through his movement as a whole, the vilest anti-Semitism for years on end. There's no possible question of that. And some of the things they said, if you read them today in the cold light of history, knowing what went between, incidentally, in Germany, they really do make your blood run cold. There was no difference whatever in the stuff that his newspaper Blackshirt published about Jews and what Streicher was publishing about Jews in the Völkische Beobachter in Germany at the same time. There was hardly a major speech of Moseley's when the fascist movement, his fascist movement was at its height, which did not contain attacks on Jews. He has pretended ever since that he was only attacking Jews because Jewish opposition to Hitler was bringing this country in towards war with Germany, and that he didn't think this country should go to war with Germany. The claim doesn't stand up to examination of his words for a moment. For instance, he's described his movement as a crusade against Jewry and against the corruption of Jewish power. At another speech, this one was in 1934, he distinguished, how kind of him, between little Jews, who were the sweepings of foreign ghettos, and big Jews, with the system of international usury by which they live. He also, when he was campaigning in the local government elections for London in 1937, put out a memorandum for his candidates and speakers, the line they should follow, etc., as every party does, of course. "You must show," he says in it, "that all the present democratic parties are Jew-ridden. No wonder the people of East London have been unable to get their long-standing grievances against the Jews ventilated." I could go on for a day and a half. How can a man who is on record with that kind of filth claim not to have used anti-Semitism? It really was like the Nazi campaign against the Jews. Incidentally, talking of the Nazi campaign, Mosley's attitude to Hitler is itself a fascinating part of all this. He once called Hitler, Adolf Hitler, "this singularly shrewd and lucid intellect," which is not bad going, I must say. And there's a notorious telegram from Mosley to Streicher, congratulating him, Streicher, on a speech he had made at a Nuremberg rally.
Bernard Levin's research uncovered example after example from the 1930s of Mosley's supporters expressing vicious hostility, not to individuals who happened to be Jewish, but to Jews as a whole.
Well, try this for an example. The Jew is a parasite with its large, hook-beaked protuberance and vile smell, with its flat, bloated appearance and its slimy trail it leaves behind when crawling. I don't really think I want to quote any more than that. That was something said by one of Mosley's lieutenants while he was in the movement, and that kind of thing, accompanied by cartoons in a similar tenor, appeared in the paper week after week after week, and Mosley was the editor-in-chief of it. He was the absolute supreme leader of the movement. Anything he said went. No nonsense about Democratic Party constitutions or anything of that kind. Mosley was the boss, and they wanted him to be the boss. He was the leader, and he could have stopped it with a word. He could have said, "We don't have this. Take all that stuff out of the paper and don't print it anymore, and don't make these speeches." He did not. He wanted it, he approved of it, and he used it. The only question remaining is whether he believed it himself or not.
Was Oswald Mosley then inherently anti-Semitic? It's a question I recently discussed with his biographer, Robert Skidelsky.
I don't think he was an anti-Semite by conviction. I think his anti-Semitism was tactical and opportunistic, and I think his line is wrong.
No doubt, is there, that Blackshirt, the paper, and the movement itself had a number of viciously anti-Semitic characteristics.
Absolutely.
And that he played up to this in many of his speeches. He would pick on people in the audience and point out that they looked Jewish.
Yeah, yeah.
Or he would mock their name if it was a Jewish name.
Yeah, especially at the Albert Hall. He read out a list of the people who'd been convicted for attacks on fascists, and, you know, they were just one Jewish name after another. And they were all from East London. And he talked about the sweepings of the ghettos and, you know, an Englishman can't walk down the street without these aliens sort of...
It's poisonous.
Well, of course it is, yeah. No, I say, I don't think it was conviction. An anti-Semite by conviction, I would guess, is someone who believes in such things as the protocols of the Elders of Zion, a world Jewish conspiracy. I don't think he believed that, but he believed that... well, what did he believe? He believed that anti-Semitism could win some support, and he also believed that later on, by the end of the 30s, his anti-Semitism was focused much more narrowly on the drift to war with Germany and the Jews being behind it.
But is there any doubt in your mind that whether he felt it in his heart or not, he used anti-Semitism?
No doubt at all.
He did?
Yeah.
The menacing language of the Black Shirts was most evident in areas like East London, with substantial Jewish populations. In Stoke, it had less resonance. There were relatively few Jews in the city, and one of them was an extremely popular local MP, so anti-Semitism found little public support. Nonetheless, to the local blackshirts, and to those appalled at their tactics, the message from Moseley came through loud and clear.
The working class were of the opinion that the capitalist system was responsible for their troubles, their economic troubles. Well, who's the capitalist system? Is anybody greater than them? I don't think so. To me, I mean, the Jewish race is just like a spider. And they've got legs here, there and everywhere in every department. Same as I say, they'll use wars, they'll use poverty, bribery, blackmail, they'll use anything to maintain their power, which they have done.
My aunt was watching television one night. Members of the National Front were on. She became very agitated and told me about a time she'd been asked to attend a meeting one night given for Moseley. Her purpose was to serve them with refreshments, mainly beer. She was very, very upset because the boss of the beer firm had been asked to provide a girl for Moseley. Lots of local, highly respected businessmen had been asked to attend this meeting, the sole purpose being that Moseley was whipping hatred up among the businessmen by telling them that in London the Jews were taking over the majority of the businesses there, the shops, and he warned that this could happen here. He asked the businessmen to sign some sort of form saying that they would back him up if he would get rid of the Jews for them. My aunt was a very big churchgoer, very religious, and she said one thing Moseley had said to the whole meeting would stay with her forever. He told the people that to get people together, you can't band people together by love, because love isn't half as strong as hate. You've got to have a common cause to hate, and Jews were the ones to hate. She never forgave the businessmen that she'd seen at this meeting. Even to the day she died, she still refused to go into certain shops in Stoke-on-Trent because she recognised these respectable businessmen. She called them hypocrites because at the meeting they'd been absolutely whipped up with hate. And there they are now, highly respectable. She never forgave them.
In the mid-1930s, hundreds of blackshirts in the Potteries seemed to lose interest in the movement's politics. What's politely referred to as the social side of fascist membership came to dominate the club in Stoke, the main social lubricant being cheap drink. Nationally, too, the story of fascism ended in complete failure. Moseley's own political career, which had started with such high promise, ended in Brixton Prison, where he was interned after the outbreak of war. Later attempts to rekindle his movement as an electoral force simply flopped. He was driven into exile and died in 1980. There's a question that continues to exercise historians like Moseley's biographer Robert Skidelsky. Why was it that the success of fascism in the 30s in Italy, Germany and Spain was never replicated here in Britain?
Partly it was because Britain had a rather light depression compared with Germany and Central Europe.
Moseley said to me that if Britain had had not 2.5 million unemployed, but 6 million unemployed, as in Germany, he would have succeeded.
Maybe, maybe. But then you see also they might have been clever enough with Keynes over there to have stopped 6 million unemployed. The British political establishment was very able, and the parliamentary system held, because when deflationary policies proved too painful, they abandoned them.
So the crisis that he was waiting for
never happened. They were too clever. I mean, that's what one expects a successful political system to be. Parliamentary system was also very legitimate in England.
And without a crisis, fascism in Britain was a hopeless cause, was it?
Yeah, it was a marginal cause. Had it not been for the war, I think it would have been a noisy and theatrical presence on the fringes of British politics for some time to come, but certainly no avenue for Moseley to come to power. I think basically what ruined Moseley was that he was on the wrong side when war came. And he has tried very hard to avoid that implication, said we would have fought and I was never in favour of a German rule in Britain or anything like that. But the fact is, people were fighting Hitler, and here was an admirer of Hitler.
Hitler had been at his wedding.
Hitler had been a guest at his wedding, yes.
The thriving headquarters of local fascism, situated here in Stoke-on-Trent's Glebe Street, is long gone. When it was closed down, many black shirts were left with nowhere to go and deserted the cause. But Sam Dunn was more resilient, and the Potteries' first black shirt also proved to be the last. In the war, he was interned on the Isle of Man as a presumed sympathiser with the enemy. When I met him 30 years ago, shortly before his death, he struck me as quite unrepentant, in his heart still wearing the uniform of the leader he revered. And frustrated by what he saw as the failure of both the ruling and working classes to restore Britain to greatness.
When a man like Moseley comes and points out something that can be beneficial to both of you, and he gives you the enthusiasm that he's a man who can do it, the belief that he can do it, well, that's it. You support him. That's why you're proud of being a National Socialist. You're saving the country from a revolution. They put me behind bars as being anti-British, pro-Hitler and all that kind of blasted thing. I'm the only true patriot. I'm the one that was a true patriot, you're not wanting the country to go to war. What have we got out of it? Now, we were the patriots. We were the ones that entitled the way the Union Jack.
Thank you. Good night. Thank you all.
Potteries Fascists was presented by Jerry Northam and produced in Bristol by John Byrne.